This is Only a Game. I'm Karen Given. In the Benetti family treasure trove of keepsakes, there's a letter Jason Benetti wrote in elementary school explaining what he wanted to be when he grew up. Jason doesn't quite remember which teacher gave him the assignment, but the guy who grew up a baseball fan in Chicago's south suburbs knows what he wrote.
I said, I want to be the White Sox announcer. And then at the end, I wrote in large letters, yes. A hat tip to Hawk Harrelson. You know, he would say, you can put it on the board. Yes.
Stretch. Get on back there. They look up. You can put it on the board. Yes. Yes.
Jason had big dreams and one big obstacle to overcome. Only a Game's Kyrie Thompson has the story.
Jason Benetti remembers practicing to be a sports broadcaster when he was 12 years old, doing voice impressions of Chicago White Sox announcer Hawk Harrelson. His announcing booth? Whatever living room he and his friends were playing video games in.
So I would play Madden or whatever baseball, Ken Griffey Jr. baseball.
Oh,
or
yes.
Whatever. Yeah, right?
Yes.
NHL 94, like that sort of thing. And I would do play-by-play of the games while I was playing with my friends.
When the games were on, Jason was in his element, having fun like any other kid. But he wasn't just any other kid. Jason was diagnosed with cerebral palsy as a toddler. He grew up hearing other kids making comments about the way he struggled to make eye contact and the way he walked.
You can't see me, but I walk with sort of a halting gait. When people see it, they don't really know what to make of it at first. I mean, I in first grade at points was at school in a wheelchair and then had like the Forrest Gump leg braces.
Jason had a passion for sports, but he wasn't able to play in organized leagues. So he tried out for the marching band at Homewood Flossmoor High School. You'd figure he'd pick up an instrument that was light and easy to carry, right? Wrong.
Oh, let me go play the tuba because it's the largest musical instrument, like David against Goliath. Let's go do it, writ large. When instead I could have just played the trumpet.
So, how'd that go?
They put a tuba on a stand for the first couple of tries at marching band for me, and basically the band would go kind of in orbit around the planetary me, which is like, if you're not trying to draw attention to yourself, not a great way to do it.
The school band instructor could see Jason was struggling, but didn't want him to feel left out. So he suggested another way for Jason to stay involved.
He sent me up to the top of the press box and had me announce the sets. And I would say, coming up next, Our Children or Wheels of a Dream or whatever it was.
Jason used his announcing gig to get into his high school's radio program.
I think like how very transparent I was about everything. Like, oh, let me go do radio because you can't see me.
Jason graduated from high school in 2001 and continued his radio broadcasting career at Syracuse University. Before long, he was running Syracuse's sports radio department. On the surface, everything was great. But Jason's rise through the ranks also dug up some familiar issues.
I get hired as the sports director, and one of the people who ended up not getting the job put up on Instant Messenger, at least he'll be a great story for somebody's magazine one day.
Jason began to wonder if his disability was all people would ever see in him.
There was a level of, I can't make a mistake, because if I make a mistake, people are going to then go back to what they saw and think that I'm just incapable of doing not only this job, but any job.
So Jason pressed on even harder. After graduating from Syracuse in 2005, he then started a decade-long stint as a minor league baseball radio announcer, while getting a law degree from Wake Forest University. The intense schedule and nagging doubts started to weigh on him.
In the minors, there are just days when you've had games 14 straight days and six-hour bus rides in between, and all of that that comes with it drains you completely and thoroughly wears you out. And there were moments where I was like, am I going to get out of here? Like, I know I'm good, but when is great gonna come?
Jason realized working in TV could help get him to the top, so he put aside his reservations about being in front of the camera, landing a part-time broadcaster job with ESPN in 2011. he started traveling the country to call college football games. His career was taking off, but he still had moments of frustration.
I'm at a college football game. I'm at my hotel, and I ask the woman at the Starbucks in the hotel to make a drink. And she looks at me and she goes, "Would you like this size or this size?" And then I start to think, well, what if she had 100 people? Would she talk that slowly to them? And that's the insidious part, right? Is I shouldn't spend mental energy on that because she doesn't mean anything by it.
Jason was still waiting for his big break when Chicago baseball found him again in 2015.
I was living in the D.C. area and the Cubs came to play the Nationals.
Jason had sent Chicago Cubs TV announcer Len Casper tapes of his work in the past, and the two had struck up a relationship.
So I asked Len, "Do you want to go to lunch?" when the Cubs were in to play the Nats, and he said, "I can't. It's like a two-game series," or whatever it was. "But after the first game, we're going to go watch the Blackhawks in the Stanley Cup Finals. You should come."
Jason took Len up on the offer. Soon after that meeting, Casper mentioned Jason's name to a few people in the White Sox organization as a possible future replacement for Hawk Harrelson, Jason's childhood idol. Hawk was 74 years old at the time. As the 2015 MLB season wound down, reports trickled out that the longtime voice of the White Sox was scaling back his workload with retirement in sight. Jason got in touch with Brooks Boyer, the White Sox head of marketing, and asked if they could meet. Brooks agreed. Jason went in expecting an informal meet and greet. It wasn't. Brooks had brought several high-ranking members of the White Sox communications department with him.
I ended up being in this room for a couple of hours, and it was a full-fledged interview.
Despite being caught off guard, Jason felt good about the interview. But the team told him there was one big meeting needed to seal the deal.
"Oh, the last step is meeting Jerry. Which, oh, no pressure. Like, don't look down from the top of the John Hancock building."
Jerry is Jerry Reinsdorf, owner and chairman of the Chicago Bulls and White Sox. In December 2015, Jason was sitting in Reinsdorf's office.
And you're looking around and it's like, oh, here are six championships and random Michael Jordan paraphernalia that everyone would kill to have. And then he walks in and offers me a cigar and I don't smoke. And I think the world is over.
Weeks came and went and Jason heard nothing from the White Sox. Over the years, he had set aside his childhood dream of working for the Sox, instead focusing on just being the best announcer he could be. But once the opportunity was within his grasp,
then I started to say, oh, I really need to be the Sox announcer again, because it kindles this flame inside of you when you get close to this thing that you wanted as a kid. And it was like, please just let him certify this.
The White Sox finally called after the new year. The job Jason Benetti had wanted since he was in elementary school was his. Jason couldn't believe it. The kid who used to do impressions of Hawk Harrelson would soon sit in the legendary broadcaster's seat.
Like, the odds of that happening are so infinitesimally small, I get that. But the odds of Hawk remaining in the job and have me be the one to actually take over for him is... They're even smaller.
Jason couldn't help but feel the butterflies before his first regular season call for the White Sox, their 2016 home opener against the Cleveland Indians. But he wasn't alone. 10 college friends flew to the ballpark to enjoy the moment with him and keep Jason loose.
We had a running gag in college that parties are better when there are pineapples at the party. So we would always get a pineapple and just have it sitting at our parties. I don't know how it started. I don't know why it started. But I do know that when I walked into the booth for my first White Sox game, there was a pineapple at my seat. Like, what are we doing here?
Whether because of the joke or because he'd done it hundreds of times before, the first game flew by for Jason. The second did too, until the seventh inning.
Avi Garcia hit a homer for the Sox.
Avi to right field. Cal Gill is back, still going, it is gone! Three-run home run, Avi Garcia breaking it.
And the ball cleared the fence, and I made the call, and I don't know why, but, like, I started to well up, and it was like, I'm 12 again. And it all kind of rushed back to me, And I still don't know exactly what it was. And I keep leaning on the power of sports and how much our childhood experiences color who we become.
Jason officially became the full-time White Sox play-by-play man this past season. He also broadcasts college football on fall weekends. The kid who avoided the camera growing up is making his voice and face known throughout the country. And he says he's learned something from a lifetime of being different.
Embrace the fact that you're weird or strange. That thing that is weird about you is probably the thing that's most fiery and most cared for deep inside of you. And if you follow that weird thing, you're probably going to be a pioneer.
That story came from Only a Game's Kyrie Thompson. If you want to catch more stories like this one, subscribe to the Only a Game podcast on Apple, Stitcher, Spotify, or wherever podcasts are peddled. The Only a Game staff might not have pipes quite like Jason Benetti's, but, you know, we try. Keith Comstock played professional baseball for 17 years, but he may be best remembered for his 1989 minor league baseball card.
You could have told me that I was a Cy Young Award winner, and I don't think I would have felt as much pride as I did that baseball card.
The story behind that legendary card coming up on Only a Game from NPR.
NPR's Code Switch is a podcast about race in America that's about all of us. Our histories, how we're represented, the ways we've worked together and worked against each other. You'll learn, you might get mad, you'll definitely laugh, but don't take my word for it. Just listen to NPR's Code Switch.
I'm Karen Given, and it's time for three stories you should know. If you had asked me last week what the biggest story by far of this week would be, I would not have said an international incident involving the NBA and China. But that's where we're going to start this week. I'm joined by Mike Pesca, host of the Daily Slate podcast, The Gist, and by The Wall Street Journal's Ben Cohen. Welcome back to both of you.
Thanks.
Thank you for having me.
Ben, you've been covering this story nonstop, so I'm sure it will be difficult to keep this short, but what should listeners know here?
Listeners should know that the NBA is in the middle of one of the most bizarre, most troubling, and probably the most consequential stories that the league has experienced for a very long time, certainly of Adam Silver, the NBA commissioner's tenure, and it all started with a tweet from Houston Rockets general manager Daryl Morey, and it was an image that said, "Fight for freedom, stand with Hong Kong." And that tweet came as the NBA was descending on China for its annual trip to Shanghai, and it was not appreciated by the government in Beijing. You described it as an international incident, which sounds both absurd and true, shockingly enough. China pulled Houston Rockets games from state-run broadcasts, and the initial response from the league was really not very clear and left itself open for misinterpretation. And the NBA had to come back about 48 hours later and offer a more forceful statement in which the league clarified what it was trying to say the first time it tried to say this. So it has been a wild week, and it has touched off questions about free speech and how U.S. businesses should operate in an oppressive regime. I mean, it's one of those stories that I think we're all still trying to wrap our heads around it.
Mike, I know you've been following the story all week, too. What do you make of all this?
Yeah, and I've been mostly following the media reaction to the story, sports bloviators, and the word that is on their lips more than any is complex or complicated. And the thing is, to anyone who's been reading the great Ben Cohen in the Wall Street Journal, who I recommend,
me too,
even just a little bit, it's not that complicated. What I mean is the actual tweet, the actual sentiment expressed by Daryl Morey to stand with the Hong Kong protesters is not complicated. It is obviously true that these people want civil rights that they had, and the oppressive regime of China wants them not to have those civil rights. He tweeted an obviously correct thing on a platform, Twitter, that isn't even allowed in China. And ESPN, with their corporate interests, you know, the people who own ESPN are Disney, and Disney has so much business interest in China, not the least of which is a $5.5 billion theme park that they literally co-own with the government of China. ESPN has been horrible in terms of getting any straight story on this, but the Wall Street Journal has been good.
ESPN, we should say, has a policy, apparently, that its people aren't allowed to talk about the story behind Morey's tweet. So they're allowed to say, oh, China is very upset, but they're not allowed to explain what the situation in Hong Kong is that caused the tweet in the first place. But Ben, I want to bring the conversation around to this question, and it does, in fact, come from one of the pieces you contributed to in the Wall Street Journal. The NBA is not the first organization to face this sort of pressure from China. Other businesses have all apologized. And here's the quote. There are other hotels, airlines, and clothing brands. There is only one NBA. Do you think that's enough to get the NBA through this without an apology?
I think that has been the most fascinating question of this entire saga. It appears that it might be. We have seen some evidence that China has taken steps to de-escalate the situation. But the idea of the NBA apology is a really interesting one here, because most people in the United States took their original statement on Sunday night as an apology, even though it was not meant to be an apology. It was apologetic, but it wasn't supposed to be an apology. Now, the most interesting part about that is that China did not accept it as an apology. So the NBA found itself under fire in the U.S. for apologizing and under fire in China for not apologizing. And that is sort of emblematic of the tricky situation that it has encountered.
All right, Mike, there was apparently some other sports slash politics news this week.
Yeah, apparently is a good word. I don't know if you knew this, but
I didn't know this, just to say.
Cory Booker unveiled a plan to end exploitation in sports. Whew. Basically what it is a list of every kind of progressive policy proposal that has ever in the last 5 years addressed athletes in sports, which doesn't say it's bad, right? It's right. Just a grab bag. It's everything.
So it's everything.
It's a little bit of the California rule about players in the NCAA owning their likeness. It's a lot about, for instance, Senator Chris Murphy's idea to, quote, bring transparency and accountability and improve educational outcomes, basically by keeping track of things like graduation rates of black athletes. But it goes so far as to, and this has got to be a first for a presidential candidate, end exploitative labor practices for NFL cheerleaders and NBA dancers. I don't mean to minimize it. The NFL cheerleaders get paid and the NBA dancers get paid a pittance. But we got a presidential policy about it. This is the one place where he could say, actually, Elizabeth Warren, I'm the only one who has a plan for that.
Well, I'm curious. I would like to know from Mike, what are the odds of this bill actually passing?
It's like 14 bills.
Well,
yeah, it's not a bill.
The plan coming to fruition.
The New Deal for jocks. Well, according to the betting markets, Cory Booker has about a 3% chance of getting elected. So, look, a lot of these things, actually, when it comes to sports, there is a lot of bipartisan appeal to it. So there are, in fact, a lot of things in this bill that probably would pass. It's just a question of, if you have only so much time to enact an agenda, how much priority do you put on the NBA dancers?
I was wondering if Cory Booker just saw California Governor Gavin Newsom sitting in a barber chair next to LeBron James and thought, I need to get in on that action, right? Like, that's where I need to be. But I think that maybe what's happening to Cory Booker here is what happens to us who work in sports journalism, which is that we think deeply about these issues in sports and we end up in kind of an echo chamber. But then I get letters and tweets from our listeners who say, what the heck are you talking about? You're all crazy. Stop messing with my sports. And I'm wondering if Booker is overestimating how far voters have come on these issues.
I think that people want justice, and they actually retreat to sports because it is more or less fair. It tries to be fair. I don't think there's a huge appetite. And if we were to rank the issues, this wouldn't be in the top 100 in public salience or actual importance. But I think it actually could only help in terms of a candidate signaling that these are some of the things I'm thinking of, and these are some of the kind of agenda items that could define my presidency.
He picked a heck of a week to combine sports and politics in this way. There's really no one talking about that collision.
That's the exquisite timing that has defined his campaign thus far.
All right, so we are a sports show. It's about time to talk about an actual sport. You all good with that? Can we do that? All right, cool. After 22 months of hype, the XFL draft has finally been set for next week. This will be the return of the league that first and last played in 2001 and fills us with nostalgia about the guy who played with He Hate Me instead of his name on the back of his jersey. This is a gamble that has failed many times before, most recently when the Alliance of American Football folded 8 games into a 10-game season earlier this year. The AAF lost a ton of money, and they said they could have made a go of it if they'd had deep enough pockets to lose $750 million in the first few years. Vince McMahon's pockets are apparently deep enough, but is money really all that matters?
I just hope he has a pretty good strategy for China after this week, honestly. No, I mean, clearly, if this is not going to make money, it's not going to last very long. But, you know, one of the things that I'm really curious about is who the people who announced the draft picks are going to be. Like, can we get He Hate Me up on the stage to bro hug the number one pick in the XFL draft?
I'd be into that. Mike, what do you think?
The commissioner of the XFL is Oliver Luck, who's Andrew Luck's father. Yeah. It would be interesting if the XFL were a little like what a state is supposed to be, to bring it back to politics, a laboratory for democracy. It would be kind of cool if the NFL had, maybe they could work with a league like this and to try out different rules. And this way we could tell that the challenging interference on a replay would be a disaster. But in general, I do not trust Vince McMahon or the McMahon family to do anything with a modicum of ethics. So I'm really quite worried about how this will be. Let's just hope no one gets seriously hurt.
Yeah.
Has Oliver Luck convinced Andrew to play quarterback in the XFL yet?
Let's hope not. Let's really, really hope not. My guests for this week's edition of Three Stories You Should Know have been Mike Pesca, host of the Daily Slate podcast, The Gist, and The Wall Street Journal's Ben Cohen. Thanks to both of you.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
Most of the time, we here at Only a Game try to tell sports stories that have a deeper meaning, that shed some light on what it means to be a human in this world. To be totally honest, our next story is not one of those, but we still think it's pretty fun. Here's Only a Game's Martin Kessler.
Keith Comstock played professional baseball for 17 years.
9 years in the minor leagues. I played 2 years over in Japan, and then I played 6 years in the big leagues, parts of 6 years.
That's a long career. When you run into baseball fans out in the world, what do they like to talk to you about mostly?
Japan. There are people that are curious about Japan, but mostly they want to talk about that baseball card. That card goes a long way in conversations.
So 17 years, that's what's risen to the top.
That's pretty much, yeah.
So picture this. Keith's got his uniform on with his hands stretched out in front of him, and he's got this horribly pained look on his face. His eyes are squeezed shut, his mouth is open like he's letting out a scream. But what makes this card truly stand out, the reason fans continue to bring it up, is the location of the baseball in the photo. And the story of how Keith made this happen, how he got this image on a real baseball card, maybe even more bizarre than the photo itself.
Yeah. There was a lot of thinking on your feet.
Growing up, Keith Comstock kept his baseball cards in two shoeboxes. One was for the special cards, the star players you wanted to hold on to. The other was for cards destined for service in Keith's bicycle spokes.
The cards only lasted like 2 or 3 days in a bicycle, so I'd always have to keep replenishing those cards. So if I got a Reggie Jackins card, you know, yeah, I saved Reggie. But if I got, and I love Dick Green. Dick Green was a hard-nosed baseball player, but if I got Dick Green from the Oakland A's, he went into my bicycle spokes and became my motorcycle.
Did you dream of having your own card?
It was, I don't think there was a dream, to be honest with you. Somewhere along the line, it became more of a vision than it did a dream.
Keith Comstock was a standout left-handed pitcher at Kenyatta College in California, where, according to the school, he once struck out 22 batters in a single game. And when Keith was 20 years old, the California Angels selected him in the fifth round of the 1976 MLB draft. Keith ended up in Iowa playing for the single-A Quad Cities Angels. That's where he got his first card as a professional baseball player.
It is not a good picture. It's black and white. It's like point blank. My eyes are all squinty. I just kind of this look on my face like I just ate a lemon or something.
But I bet when you got it, it was still pretty amazing to see.
Oh, yeah. And the thing was, I didn't know if I was going to get another one or not.
But Keith would get plenty more minor league baseball cards. More than he'd want, in fact. And there's something important to know about minor league baseball cards. Unlike major league cards, which feature action shots from actual games, minor league cards, at least back then in the late 70s, used posed photos. So as he toiled away in the minors for the next 5, 6, 7 years, Keith became very familiar with the limited pose options.
You're lifting your leg and you're holding your balance point. The other one is when you're finishing a follow-through and the ball's still in your hand, it looks like you're about ready to release it. There's other ones that you would kind of just sit there in a stretch position or in a wind-up position before you even started. Those got boring. And unfortunately, the reason why I got tired of doing the same thing was because I was in the minor leagues for so long.
But in 1987, 11 years after he was drafted, Keith finally stayed in the majors long enough with the San Diego Padres to earn his first big league card.
And so when you get that first card in the mail, man, it was just nothing like it, at least not for me. I played with Ken Griffey Jr., and I'm sure his first baseball card was a totally different experience because it was a year after high school. Mine was, you know, I'm almost in my 30s, for crying out loud. So it was justification of me sticking through it. But that first card I got, I remember I was still at my mom's house, and my dad had passed away years earlier. And my mom and I saw it, and I gave it to my mom right away. Now, she might have put it in my bicycle spoke for all I know.
But after finally getting a real taste of the big leagues, Keith Comstock got sent back down to the minors. He ended up on the AAA Las Vegas Stars for the 1988 season. He was now 32 years old, playing for a team stacked with young prospects. And then one day, the photographer from Pro Cards showed up.
It was a Sunday morning. He was running late, and he wanted to get things done. It was kind of a big setup.
The photographer had a checklist with all the players on the roster, and he was having them go through the usual poses.
Holding your balance point, finishing and follow through, and just sit there in a stretch position or a wind-up position.
For Keith Comstock, who'd been in the minor leagues for so long, who'd finally gotten a real Major League Baseball card, this was tough to take. So before it was his turn, Keith basically snapped.
I'm like, I'm tired. I want to do something different.
Now, the creative process can be mysterious, and Keith's not sure where exactly this particular stroke of inspiration came from. But Keith decided that he wanted, no, needed, his baseball card to feature him taking a baseball to the crotch.
I just said, I'm going to take it to the nuts. And then, you know, to make a face like what that ball of hitting you in that area and how much it would hurt.
After some trial and error, Keith figured out he could get the ball to stick to his pants for at least a few seconds with the help of some super glue. Keith presented the idea to the photographer.
He's like, hey, I don't know about this. I can't do this. I'm under strict orders about just taking set shots. I've got picture shots here, balance points. He's telling me all these kind of poses that he wants me to do. And I said, been there, done that. And he goes, no, I can't take it, man. I'm sorry. So he drew his line in the sand, and he just didn't think I was going to come across.
Keith and the photographer had reached a stalemate. And that's when one of Keith's fellow relievers had an idea. It would require the support of the younger prospects up in the clubhouse who hadn't yet come down to take their photos.
He said, hey, just go up there and tell these guys not to come down until you've taken this picture. Tell them what you want to do.
In other words, use the prospects as leverage to get the photographer to budge. Keith was on board to give it a shot. And what did you say to the guys? What was your pitch to them?
It wasn't a big, you know, like that big Mel Gibson Braveheart speech.
I'm dying in your beds many years from now.
Anything that was inspirational by any means.
For one chance, just one chance to come back here and tell our enemies.
It wasn't like I thought up a big thing where I had people in tears or fawning to fight for me and screaming. Yeah. It was more or less guys reading the paper saying, whatever, man. Yeah, there, go ahead, go. I'm all for it. Go ahead.
With that vigorous backing from his teammates, Keith Comstock returned to the photographer.
And so I just walked over to him saying, hey, they're not going to come down. They're young. I'm old. I want this picture done. They know how much I want it done. So we got to get this done. He goes, all right, get over there. So boom, we got it done.
That next season, with Keith still playing for the AAA Las Vegas Stars, the card showed up at the clubhouse.
Oh, son of a gun, there it is. And I was so proud of myself. I mean, you could have told me that I was a Cy Young Award winner, and I don't think I would have felt as much pride as I did that baseball card.
I mean, yeah, there have been a lot of Cy Young winners. How many people had...
There's only one baseball card like that.
Except not anymore. In the 30 years since Keith's famous card showed up in that 1989 pro card set, at least one other player has imitated his pose. And with that kind of legacy, Keith Comstock shouldn't have to worry about that card ending up in anyone's bicycle spokes.
That's Only a Game's Martin Kessler. We first learned about the saga of Keith Comstock's baseball card in his ESPN piece with Robert Sanchez. We'll have a link at onlyagame.org. Keith is also collaborating on a forthcoming novel based on his career called The Con Man. Most people knew boxer Joe Frazier by his powerful left hook and his bitter rivalry with Muhammad Ali. But there's a lot more to the story.
In a sport that many think is inhumane, Joe had a great humanity.
That's coming up. And remember, you can follow us on Facebook and Twitter at OnlyAGameNPR.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, one of the hosts of On Point, the NPR show that takes you behind the headlines. We've done a deep dive series on education, and all episodes are available to binge now. Listen to On Point now on NPR One or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Karen Given. California Governor Gavin Newsom signed landmark legislation giving college athletes the right to sign endorsement deals. Next week on Only a Game, he explains why he signed the bill while sitting in a barber's chair. But first, Charlie Pierce is here with the week's news. Hi, Charlie.
Well, he obviously wants to give the players a cut of the revenues.
I love it. The WNBA has a new champion. The Washington Mystics earned their first title on Thursday night with a win over the Connecticut Sun. It's also a first for league MVP Elena Della Dunn, who had been to the finals twice before but never came away with a ring. This time, she was playing with three herniated discs in her back, but female athletes aren't tough, right?
Oh, man, that's really, even a sprained back, which I've had, or, you know, a pulled muscle in your back, it paralyzes you. And playing with three herniated discs for a league championship, and of course now they have the WNBA, and the Nationals are still alive.
Joe Biden recently showed off his deep support for the WNBA with a tweet wishing Della Dunn well as she recovers and, quote, looking forward to seeing her back on the court soon. The only problem was he tweeted this during halftime of Game 3, and Della Dunn had already returned to the court. oops?
Not at halftime. She was not at the court. There's nothing wrong with what Joe Biden said.
He was looking forward to coming back out of the locker room.
After halftime, he wanted to make sure, you know, nothing went wrong with the three herniated discs in the locker room.
Baseball's championship series are set. In the ALCS, we've got the Houston Astros and the New York Yankees. I generally root for whoever's playing the Yankees. Will I be disappointed?
I don't think so. I think it'll be a terrific series. And the Astros are a very kind of lovable team. So you can adopt them with a clear conscience.
Excellent. Cardinals manager Mike Schilt struck just the right tone in the locker room after St. Louis beat Atlanta to reach the NLCS. I'm going to play a bit of his post-game speech, and just a warning to listeners, some of the language is quite raw. Inspirational, don't you think?
I am ready to run through a wall for that man. Seriously. That is old school baseball right there. That's the kind of thing that anybody who grew up reading Ball 4 can appreciate.
The Cardinals will face the Washington Nationals, who beat the Dodgers to clinch their first postseason series win. I know the Nationals have only been the Nationals since 2005, but this feels like a long time coming, doesn't it?
Yeah, well, they've been flirting with this for a while, and they've got a very talented team. But stuff always happened to them. This time, you know, they happened to the Dodgers, and specifically to Clayton Kershaw, who's going to wind up going to the Hall of Fame, maybe, with the worst postseason record of anybody there.
Right. It was no surprise when NFL coach Jay Gruden got fired on Monday. After all, Washington was 0-5 and had just lost to New England 33-7. But I am a little surprised that team owner Daniel Snyder made him come into the stadium at 5 a.m. on Monday to hear the news. That seems unnecessarily cruel, doesn't it?
Oh, yeah, but it's Daniel Snyder. I mean, it's his way of doing business. And I'm sure if Gruden had just said, yeah, you know, fire me over the phone, I'm going back to bed, Snyder would have, you know, found a way to weasel out of the money he owed him.
Well, Gruden's brother John coaches for the Oakland Raiders, and when asked for comment, he said, "Welcome to the club, bro." We should mention that John actually started a club back in 2008. It's called the Fired Football Coaches Association, and I don't know if they actually have meetings, but if they do, I want to go to one.
Well, the problem is that would include, like, every coach who ever coached in the NFL, except maybe George Halas.
It's a big group. They need, like, a conference center. And finally, Charlie, hilarity ensued on Monday night when the Braves-Cardinal game on TBS ran long and Turner Broadcasting decided to move the Dodgers-Nationals game over to TNT. And that was a bad idea because why?
Use the force, Karen, and figure it out. There was a Star Wars movie scheduled, and one does not get in the way of the Star Wars people. National pastime? Sorry. We have Ewoks and Banthas.
Charlie Pierce is the guest editor of the Best American Sports Writing 2019, and he joins us each week here at Only a Game. Thanks, Charlie.
Thank you, Karen.
The rivalry between Joe Frazier and Muhammad Ali went far beyond the boxing ring. Just days before their second fight, 1974's Ali-Frazier II, the heavyweights met at ABC's New York television studios for an interview with Howard Cosell.
Well, that shows how dumb
come
you
people
are.
Going
that shows how dumb you are. How
come people- Ali called Frazier ignorant. Frazier rose from his chair and stood over Ali. Their handlers tried to intervene, but soon the two were wrestling on the floor.
Well, we're having a scene, as you can see, and it's hard to tell whether it's clowning or for real between the two fighters.
It was real, and it kept going. Over the years, Ali called Frazier a savage, a gorilla, and an Uncle Tom. Ali later apologized, but his words hurt Frazier, because much of what people thought they knew about him wasn't true. Only a Game's Gary Wallach has the story.
Joe Frazier was born in 1944 in Beaufort, South Carolina. He was one of 12 children. His father was a bootlegger.
His mother picked vegetables in the fields, as did many other members of his family.
That's writer Mark Cram Jr.
He grew up in a house that was more or less a shack. He grew up amid malnutrition, disease, and essentially the enslavement of the Jim Crow laws. You couldn't look a white man or a white woman, in, particularly a white woman, in the eye for fear of retribution. He said that Buford never got tired of reminding you that you were the N-word.
But Frazier's mother had a rule.
Dolly would not stand for anything said about white people. You know, if her kids made some sort of offhanded remark, she'd slap them down. She wouldn't stand for it.
But that didn't mean Frazier suffered abuse easily. Once, when Joe was in his teens, he was working at a farm in Beaufort. When a white foreman threatened to take a belt to another young African American, Frazier stopped him. He just couldn't stand watching others being pushed around.
And that's fundamental to his nature.
In 1959, Frazier saw no future in Beaufort outside of working in the fields and helping his father run the family still. So he hopped on a Greyhound bus headed for New York City, where he joined members of his extended family. He was just 15. But there wasn't much of a future in New York City either.
He found it hard to find work and to supplement what little money he had. He and a friend would steal cars and sell them to junkyards. There was a sense among his family that if he stayed in New York, it wouldn't be a positive outcome for him. So they sent him down to Philadelphia to live with his sister, Maisie. She sat down with Joe and she said, "Look, if you get into trouble down here, there's nothing I can do for you."
Maisie suggested that Joe join the Police Athletic League. At least he'd be safe in a gym filled with cops.
So he went over to the gym, and when he hit the heavy bag, it made such a resounding crack that you could hear it across the street.
Over the next few years, Frazier rose quickly up the boxing ranks. He won gold at the 1964 Olympics. In 1968, he captured the New York Athletic Commission heavyweight title, which marked the beginning of a long championship run.
Muhammad Ali rocked him to the rope. He almost went down.
In 1971, Frazier fought Muhammad Ali in what was billed as the fight of the century at Madison Square Garden. In the lead-up to the fight, Ali intensified his attacks on Frazier, saying he was too dumb and ugly to be champ, and calling him an Uncle Tom for working with white trainers. It was the biggest sporting event of the year.
The winner by unanimous decision and still heavyweight champion of the world, Joe Frazier.
Frazier was now a celebrity. Politicians wanted to see and be seen with him. On April 7, 1971, just 1 month after his win over Ali, Frazier became the first African-American man to speak before the state legislature in Columbia, South Carolina.
It was an extraordinary event. He reached out and tried to implore the members of that assembly to be open to bringing the races together. And he wanted to.
Frazier told the legislature that not much had changed since he left Beaufort, about 140 miles south of the state capital. And he said,
"We must save our people. And when I say our people, I mean white and black."
That's an actor reading from Joe Frazier's address.
"We need to quit thinking who's living next door, who's driving a big car, who's my little daughter going to play with? Who is she going to sit next to in school?"
Publicly, they were all for it. The governor was behind him. The politicians shook his hand. They were thrilled to have him. He was the champ.
After his address to the state legislature, Frazier sent a representative to Beaufort to propose the building of a public playground that he would pay for himself. But when officials learned that Frazier wanted the playground to be open to black children and white children, with one water fountain for all of them,
he was slapped down.
When news reached Frazier in Philadelphia that Buford officials wouldn't agree to his terms,
Joe said forget it then, because he wasn't going to be a party to furthering the separatism. It bothered Joe. That's not what Joe was about.
While Frazier was losing this private battle, Ali continued attacking him in public. In May of 1971, Frazier took a portion of his $2.5 million Fight of the Century purse and purchased the Bruton Plantation in Beaufort.
His family, generations back, had been enslaved in places of this sort, and now he was the owner of one. The symbolism shouts at you.
Frazier's mother lived at Bruton Plantation along with other family members. Frazier continued to live in Philly, but
he basically kept his ties to Beaufort. In fact, all during his life, he was connected to Beaufort.
Joe Frazier's boxing career ended in 1981. He continued to run his boxing gym.
He was available. You didn't need to make an appointment to find Joe Frazier in Philadelphia. All you had to do was walk up to the gym on North Broad Street, walk in, and he would have genuine time for you. He performed all these acts of generosity that the public never really knew about or found out about. He would see a motorist stranded on the side of the road with a flat tire, and he would pull over, get out of his car, get the jack out of the trunk, and fix the tire. He did this not just once, but again and again. It was almost as if he was his own AAA. And, you know, his friends who were driving with him, it became such a commonplace occurrence that they say, "Oh, Joe, not again." He'd say, "Well, what if it was your mother that was stranded there?"
On a cold December day in 1986, Joe was driving in Philadelphia with his son and another boxer. He spotted a legless man in a wheelchair trying to cross Broad Street. The man had a can of kerosene in his lap.
Joe pulled over, stopped in the middle of Broad Street, got out of the car in his fur coat and a cowboy hat, picked the guy up and put him in his car, drove him home.
The only items in the man's home were a table and chairs, a television, and two kerosene heaters.
The man's wife couldn't believe that Joe Frazier was standing there in the middle of her living room, and he takes a roll out of his sock and peels off a couple $100. And the guy says, "Why are you doing this?" He couldn't believe it. And Joe would say, "You need help, man." That was his nature. In a sport that many think is inhumane, Joe had a great humanity. He was a good man, not a perfect man, but a good man.
Joe Frazier made many trips back to Beaufort to visit family. Over the years, he noticed that something had changed.
He would come to town and he was treated very well, far better than he was when he was even champ.
In 2010, Joe Frazier was presented with the Order of the Palmetto, South Carolina's highest civilian award. The state that had rejected Frazier's vision of racial harmony was now honoring him. Ali tried on many occasions to apologize for his name-calling, but Frazier refused to forgive him. Joe Frazier died in 2011. What did the boxing world in particular and the greater world in general lose?
Someone who understood that being the champion meant more than just holding a belt in your hand. It meant that you had a voice. And even if you did not use that voice in the public square, you could use it privately and in ways that helped people along the way. He understood that.
That story came from Only a Game's Gary Wallach. Mark Cram Jr.'s new book is called Smokin' Joe, The Life of Joe Frazier. Only a Game is produced by Martin Kessler and Gary Wallach, with help this week from Jonathan Chang and Paul Kahlo. Our technical director is Marquise Neal. Our executive producer is me. I'm Karen Given. Only a Game returns next week. Thanks for listening.